The Pacific Group is an open meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. All members of the community are welcome to attend. The single most important aspect of AA recovery, however, is the principle of one alcoholic relating to another alcoholic. Therefore, only alcoholics actually participate in our meetings. If your primary problem is other than alcoholism, we think it would also be helpful to you to contact an anonymous organization that more specifically deals with your addiction. In any case, we hope that what you learn here may be helpful to your recovery and or understanding. Good evening. My name is Dave Mangrum, and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Pacific Group of Alcoholics Anonymous. The format of this meeting is two 10-minute speakers followed by a main speaker. Speakers, please note you'll be given 5-minute and 1-minute reminders when it's time to wrap up your talk. Our first 10-minute speaker is Ernest L.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Ernest Landrum, and I'm an alcoholic. I want to welcome anybody that's new. And first of all, I want to thank Marty for asking me to do this. Then I'd like to welcome anybody that's new or returning. Glad to be here. It's a pleasure to see all of you. My sobriety date is August the 10th, 1990. My sponsor is Thomas Sells. And this, of course, is my home group. I came from a... My parents were both normies. Neither one of them drank. I probably only need a few fingers to count the number of times I saw my mother take a drink. It was usually when company came from out of town. They'd share a pint of Seagram's gin and some 7-Up. There were no fights. There were no arguments. I don't know how they pulled that off. My father was a normie by default. He simply could not tolerate alcohol. It wouldn't stay down, and apparently, he didn't give it enough. He didn't work at it long enough. But he liked to keep alcohol in the house for when guests came. I remember my brothers and I tasting some of the stuff, but never to the point where any one of us got drunk. It wasn't until I was about 14 years old, my best friend and I, Jackie, scored a bottle of cheap wine somewhere. And he lived with his grandmother, and we went to the basement and we drank, and mine stayed down. Jackie's didn't. It started getting near the time his grandmother was going to get home from work, and I couldn't help him with that. I split. I don't remember any more involvement with alcohol then until about high school age, when I went to work at an ice cream parlor, Farrell's Ice Cream Parlor restaurant. And it was all teenagers, high school kids and college kids. And I remember the topic of most conversations seemed to involve alcohol, particularly beer. And there was all this talk, jokes about beer. And they had these parties, keggers. I got introduced to keggers. I was finally invited to one. So I'm finally going to have beer and join the club, see what this is all about. And I remember getting there, and they handed me a beer, and I tasted it, and I thought, this is some nasty tasting stuff. What is all the talk been about? It's a big deal. But I kept coming back. I struggled with that beer all evening, and I got invited to another kegger, and I drank again and again, and finally I acquired a taste for beer. And it was fun. I drank through the rest of high school. I drank through college. I graduated college. I got a part-time job right out of school while I prospected for full-time work. I worked in the liquor and gourmet section of a department store on the old Broadway. So there was a book that the manager asked me to read. It was about the history of all of these alcoholic beverages. And that really piqued my interest. And continued on drinking. And finally, I got a full-time job, and it was very stressful. And I remember for the first time starting to notice my alcohol consumption. You see, like at home, I kept alcohol around, but although I had graduated, I took a couple classes at night and I continued with that part-time job. And I wasn't home a lot, but I'd buy these big bottles of alcohol and they'd become consumed. And I remember noticing that and getting a little concerned. And it was about the time when a liquor store opened in my community. It had a lot of opposition at first, but he got through and he said this wasn't going to be an ordinary liquor store. And it wasn't. Had a great deli in there, sold nice brands and unusual things. And I had check-in privileges there. And it was really, important to me that I could write checks there. So I got a little concerned, and I remember there were these commercials, public service commercials about alcoholism. And it was like they would offer like a mini version of the 20 questions. And they'd ask, do you drink every day? Or they'd ask about how often you drink. Do you drink alone? And I remember I would close my ears to those questions. I wouldn't allow myself to answer them because I had this very negative picture in my mind about what an alcoholic looked like. And I didn't identify. In my mind, an alcoholic was this scuffy old man in an ill-fitting suit from a thrift store, dress shoes with no socks, a bottle of alcohol in a brown bag, and perhaps sitting or sleeping in a doorway somewhere. I don't know where I got this, but that was my image of an alcoholic, and so I could not identify with that. Well, we move into the 80s. Then, though I identify as an alcoholic, drugs are part of my story. At that time, I started to use substances as well. It was no longer fun. It became fun with problems. And I was working at a bank, and as my drinking accelerated, in addition to the drug use, money became tight, and came tight to the point that the line between their stuff and my stuff at the bank started to blur, and I had to leave that job. About July of 1990, I won the lottery. I was walking down the street one day, and there were a couple of guys from who approached me, and reluctantly, I stopped to talk with them. I could tell they were churchy types, and they were. They were from a church in the neighborhood that had a men's Bible study. And once a month, it was the will of the pastor that they went out and just talked to people. Well, they engaged me, and I disclosed that I was alcoholic and that I wanted to be sober. One of these men happened to be sober, and he told me about a meeting at his church. And so I showed up at that meeting after the battle in my mind for the next several days. You don't really need that. You can do it on your own. If you go to this meeting, you're going to miss your swimming lessons. But somehow the time came for that meeting. And with everything in me, I drank a beer and I smoked a joint and I made my way to that meeting. And I got there and I was directed to this room where the meeting took place. And I had tried some meetings before, but this one was different. It was brightly lit and the people there were, I identified a little more. They talked like me. They shared the same kind of problems. I came back the next week and they remembered my name and it just felt very welcoming. I still had a problem with identifying as an alcoholic. But at this meeting, it was a 12-step meeting, but it was nonspecific. There were overeaters, alcoholics, suspenders, everybody with any kind of compulsion or what have you. And they allowed me to identify as Ernest, and I have a substance abuse problem. Well, the turn of events, I needed to get some outside help with my anger. And I found a place that gave me something that I associated with our fourth step inventory. Bunch of questions. And the last question was briefly describe the three most traumatic experiences of your life. And when I identified those, I realized that until that night, I had never shared them with a single individual. And I had never even processed them emotionally until then. Well, this meeting was a step study. We went through the steps in rotation every week. So I wondered what else was there that I'm not aware of. And I had heard over and over that you work the steps in rotation and you're working with a sponsor. And I had been unwilling to consider a sponsor until then. I wanted to know what else was there. The next meeting I attended, this guy was setting up by himself and I joined him and we talked. And at the end of setting up the meeting, he said, I'm going to be your sponsor. And his name was Derek, and he became my sponsor. He introduced me to the steps and introduced me to service and started me on my way. I became a GSR, worked in general service for several years. I got a new life here. I got another chance at life. And if you're new or you're returning here, I hope you find what I found. I came here with a lot of anger, a lot of baggage, and I was guided by my feelings. And one of the biggest lessons that I've learned is that feelings are not facts. My feelings are a terrible basis to make decisions. They're going to change in 5 minutes or 5 hours or 5 days. And I'm grateful for the new life, the way of living, the design for living that I found here, and the tools that I've been able to implement in my life. And I hope you find the same thing too. Thank you for letting me share.
Thanks, Ernest. Our second 10-minute speaker is Carol T.
Good evening. My name is Carol. I'm an alcoholic. I want to thank Marty for asking me to share. It really is a privilege, although a frightful one. I haven't had much sleep the last 2 nights trying to think through my years of sobriety. I get sober May the 26th of 1985 and celebrated 35 years of sobriety last year. I feel like I'm not a good representative of Alcoholics Anonymous because I only drank badly for about 8 years. I was drunk the first time when I was about 20 years old. Now, if I had been smarter than I thought I was, I could have saved myself a lot of trouble because my first drunk, I was away from my family at a meeting and started drinking gin and tonic until I felt like I was going to get sick and throw up. So I had to excuse myself from the room, went out to the back of the meeting hall and threw up and had dry heaves. I don't remember how I got home. I know I did get home, but what I learned from that experience was not don't drink, but stay away from gin. Because gin, actually, for most of my sobriety, I decided that white-colored alcohol was bad for me and it didn't mesh with my system. The reason I didn't drink for the longest time, I think, was because of my father's experience with alcohol, and he drank badly for a number of years. I remember seeing my mother cry because my father came home drunk. And it was, although I felt sorry for him, I didn't want to drink. The good thing about that is that I was able to, finish 2 years of a secretarial training class and got a job, went to work at a university, and was able to take classes along the way. I finished my bachelor's degree. I graduated at the top of my college. I was above average, which is all I ever wanted to be. I never wanted to be average. And from what I can tell from looking over my life, I have never been average. I'm not sure it's a good thing, but it is. It's my story. My drinking, I think I probably could have been drunk maybe 6 times throughout my 20s. The thing that broke my heart was the breakup of my marriage. And without being, given any kind of advice about how to handle the situation, I immediately started drinking Jack Daniels. I don't know why, other than it's made in Tennessee, which is where I was born. I'm the second good thing to come out of the state of Tennessee to California. So I started drinking every day. I also indulged in some non-alcoholic relief. And I was trying to finish I was working on a graduate degree at the university, and I decided alcoholically one day that I needed to take the master's screening exam though I wasn't prepared for it, I went in and answered questions which I was not prepared to answer. And I, you know, I went immediately afterwards and went back to drinking. They had an alcohol awareness, you know, abuse awareness week at the university, and some friends of I went to this seminar, and they, you know, they forgot to bring dump buckets, you know, for the excess wine that you were supposedly going to throw out. Well, I don't believe in wasting any of it, so I managed to get drunk. I had and went back to class, had to leave the class, and, you know, ended up going to the student health center because that, you know, because I had some kind of alcohol overdose. Whenever I started drinking, I didn't know when to stop. It wasn't a matter of knowing, it was a matter of not being able to. I finally went to see a psychologist the last year of my drinking. From February of 84 to February of 85, I experienced the death of my grandmother, my mother, and my father. And I told the psychologist, excuse me, you would drink too if you had experienced the things I'd experienced. Of course, I'm sure I'm not the only one who's lost close family members. So he suggested that I go to some AA meetings, to go to the speaker meetings. And I did that for about a couple of months, but I couldn't relate because, I mean, I remember one guy telling a story about being running naked down Ventura Boulevard and, you know, in a drunken stupor. And I certainly couldn't relate to that. On Memorial Day weekend, I ended up calling in sick to work. I had finished off a six pack from the night before and was already, you know, was drunk already. Called a friend who sent me, you know, who suggested I not go into work, call in sick. And I had went to the women's stag that night, met a woman who gave me your phone number. I called her the next morning, met her at the Saturday Night Way of Life group. I don't know why I did it, but I had never kept promises to anybody, but for some reason, I knew I had to get to that meeting. I set the alarm clock so I wouldn't miss the meeting. Got up, met the woman that was to become my sponsor. That was the 25th of May. And we started the path through the Pacific Group, a meeting every night. And my life began there. I went for a number of years without going to meetings. I don't recommend that to anybody. It tells me that I am self-will run riot. The only thing that saved me was my continual involvement, listening to Clancy at the Wednesday night meeting, going to my friend Judy's Thanksgiving and Christmas dinners, going to my class banquets. The beauty of the Pacific Group for me is that you never have to be alone. You never have to do anything alone. And despite that, I still think I can figure it out. But for today, I'm sober. I don't know. I'm convinced that I would not be alive today if I hadn't stopped drinking when I did. I was almost 40 years old. And life has been good to me up until the last couple of years. I've had some serious health problems, a heart attack, a serious lung infection, which is still being treated. But the Zoom meetings have been a respite from life and on life's terms. I really do hope that those people who are new to this meeting or who are coming back to the meeting will jump right in and do the things that are suggested of you. I have a sponsor who I've had the entire sobriety. I need to call her. And I've been to most of my AA class banquets. The class of 85 came alive in 85, right on. It's one of the best classes in the Pacific group by my estimation, if not the best. Clancy said that. This has been a nerve-wracking experience. I don't share much, but I know I've never turned down a request to share, because I understand that part of my recovery is to be honest and open and share whenever I'm asked to share. Without proving that I'm babbling, I'll close for now. Thank you for being there.
Our main speaker tonight is Tracy B.
Hi, everybody. My name is Tracy, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am so, so honored to be with you guys tonight. As you will see in just a little bit, this group means absolutely everything to me. And I just want to thank Marty. Thank you so much for the privilege of being allowed to tell my story, as it says in the book. And to the newcomers, let me tell you, you have stepped into, I like to call it Maximum Strength Alcoholics Anonymous. I drank Maximum Strength, and I got to have Maximum Strength AA, and you have stepped into the middle of it. So stay put, hang on. You're in for, your life is about to change in ways you had no idea. So stay with them. So I'm actually not from Arizona. I am from Texas, Lubbock, Texas. And I come from a crazy, crazy, violent alcoholic home. And I tell you that not to blame my alcoholism on that, but I will tell you that shapes who you are. It doesn't define who you are, but it shapes who you are. My real father went to prison when I was just a baby, and I didn't meet him till I was 18 years old. And he doesn't want anything to do with me, and I honor his request. So my mom married from the gangster. She went to the cowboys. She went to the rodeo grounds and found my dad, who I called my dad. He was an extremely violent alcoholic. And I have to tell you, at about 2 o'clock in the morning at our house every night, it came alive. And I never knew. I had a little brother by this time, and we never knew, what the next 30 minutes was going to be. We didn't know if we were getting in the car and going to a hotel. We didn't know if we were hiding in the closet, or if we were all going to get to take a breath and go to bed. But I'll tell you what that did for me is every day when I went to school, I knew that you knew that my house was the white trash house on the block. I knew you knew the craziness that went on in my house. And I didn't look anybody in the eye. I looked at the ground. I didn't have friends. I didn't hang out with anybody. And I had a cloak of shame that just enveloped me. That's who I was. I was a kid who was ashamed. I was embarrassed. Somewhere down the line, my mom found this thing called Al-Anon. I didn't know anything about it except a couple of things. One, she left my dad. Two, all of a sudden butterflies appeared everywhere in my house. Back then they did, their little theme was butterflies, and they were all over my house. Everywhere in my house. And the other thing I noticed is she would be on the phone a lot with these gals, and she would say, "Oh, honey, it's just Tuesday. We're just going to get through Tuesday." And I thought, those people are so dumb. They don't know what day it is. They can't read calendars. That's what I knew. But the other thing that happened was to change my life. My mom left that crazy alcoholic family. And my mom was uneducated, and she had two little kids to take care of, and no money. And I know that she did the very best that she could do to get us out of that craziness. And she moved us out into the country, into what I call a one-room shack. There was one bedroom, and my little brother and I shared the laundry room. We had bunk beds. The floor was falling out in the bathroom, and the ceiling was falling down in her room. And one more time, I was so embarrassed. I had that cloak of shame one more time. And when the school bus came and picked us up, my little brother and I would walk down the street. So they would pick us up down the street. And you didn't know one more time that I was the white trash. I was embarrassed. I just felt so uncomfortable in my skin. I always thought if I could just unzip, step out, it would be all right. And the other thing I always truly, truly wanted, I just wanted a normal mom and dad, frilly curtains, white picket fence, and go to the football game on Friday night with Bob. I mean, that's what I really, really wanted. I knew that was not my story. I knew that was not going to be my life. So I was, I don't know, alcohol was always around our house, but somewhere around, I'm not really sure, 13, 14, something like that. Jay. Now, Jay was a bad boy, and Jay paid attention to me. And if you're a girl like me, when a boy like that pays attention to you, that piques my interest. Jay had long blonde hair. He drove a green GTO. He had the big black boots, and he jingled when he walked. He had the wallet that was in his back pocket with the chain from his belt loop to his wallet. So he kind of jingled when he walked. And Jay asked me if I wanted to go hang out. And I said, you betcha. So when Jay picked me up that night and pulled up in front of my house on that dirt road and that green GTO, I jumped in that car with full of excitement. And in that car was two brown paper sacks, one for me and one for him. His was a six pack of Bud, and mine was a bottle of Boone's Farm Strawberry Hill. And I got to tell you, my life changed that night. My perception changed that night in lots of ways that we'll just leave right there. But what it did for me is it changed who I was. That cloak of shame was gone. I felt the effects produced by alcohol that night. It changed everything. And I have to tell you, from that moment on, my mother and I went to war, because I found something that made me okay. I found something that made me able to breathe. People used to say, you know, if you would just stop drinking, and they just, you know, how do you explain to them that that's the solution? When I'm not drinking is when it's the problem. That's when that spring inside, it gets tighter and tighter and twisting and twisting. The drink makes that thing pop and relax. So of course, my mom and I went to war. I was in high school. I used to do the cry of just let me do what I want to do. And one night she did. We had a fist fight and she kicked me out on the streets, and I was probably about 16 or 17 years old, quit high school and became a waitress at Pizza Hut. And my life was taken off. A couple of months down the road, there was a little incident with I fake being raped one particular night, and police were involved, and my mom was involved, and all our Al-Anons, and the result of that lie was I did move back home. I did get to graduate high school, and it's going to be different. I'm going to be okay now. And I go off to college. Well, you know what happens? We find our kind. We find the people that drink like I do. And I quickly, I used to say I dropped out of college. They invited me to leave college because I didn't do school. I was at the bars every night, and just, it seemed like trouble followed every step I took. My best friend and I were in a fight, and she was stabbed three times, and we were in a courtroom one more time. And I went to college on probation, so I had to check into my parole office first. It was always drama around me. I broke my foot one night, drunk, didn't even know it till the next morning with my foot swollen. And, you know, it just, college didn't seem to be working out for me. So I decided that I would try a new career. And I found the career for you and me, and that's a bartender. And I became a bartender, one for you, one for me. And I thought I had found heaven. But you know, there's always that inner voice, that inside, that things just aren't okay. Life is not okay. I am not okay. You know, boys and booze went together for me. And you know, if you're a woman of my type, you know what that means. And every night, a little piece of your soul is handed out every single night. It was July of 1984. Now, my mom had met this, I thought he was the president of this group called Pacific Group, something in Los Angeles. Jim Shaw, he had this deep, dark voice. And I thought that, you know, he was a president, but my mom and he, you know, they met, they married, and she was going off to Los Angeles, and I had a drink and, you know, toasted them on to AA Al-Anon happiness, you know. And my mom would come back every year to the convention in Lubbock. And it was July of 1984. And my mom came back for the convention and I decided to go see her. I always felt when I go hear those speakers, I just love their stories and it put me in a good mood. And I always felt like when I got to the bar, I was like two drinks ahead. So I went to go hear my mom speak. And I mean, I went to the convention to see my mom. And it was Friday night. And there was a speaker there named Johnny H. And Johnny said, I'm sure he gave a profound talk, but what I heard was this. I heard him say, I've always wanted frilly curtains and a white picket fence. And I thought, somebody knows my secret. How does he know my secret? And I don't know why, but for some reason, I heard a little piece of, just a little piece I heard. I decided to come back Saturday night, and the speaker on Saturday night was a man named Father Leo. Father Leo talked about the wind whipping through his gut, and he couldn't feel that hole up anymore. And he talked about the alcoholic loneliness that only another alcoholic understood. And I understood. And I started shaking my head. And it was the first time, as the big book says, a message of depth and weight. And it was a message of depth and weight. I had been to many meetings, but this one I heard. The grace of God was sitting in the chair right beside me that night. I've heard people say, you know, that God's a gentleman. He doesn't come uninvited. Well, my God does. Mine comes uninvited all the time. Thank God he does that, because he was with me that night and I heard what I needed to hear. There was a man there named Albert Myers from Dallas, and he was friends with my mom and Jim. And he kind of pulled me aside and had a little conversation and told me some things that only I could hear from him. And he told me about a little piece of white velvet inside all of us that God doesn't let get tarnished, and to hang on to that. And I did that. They told me immediately after that convention, you go straight to a meeting. So Sunday night, I was sitting in a meeting at the Hub of the Plains. I think my mom might have called ahead, possibly, because there were some people waiting for me at the door. And I want to tell you, I stepped into the middle of the hand of God. I loved being sober. I found a group of people, a young people's meeting. We were active. We had fun. I felt like I could finally tell the truth. I felt like I could be honest. I felt like I could be myself. I loved being sober. I was told some real basic things. Get a sponsor, get a home group, take commitments. No major changes your first year. No relationships your first year. You got to change your playmates, playgrounds, and playthings. And I did all of those almost. There was this one little thing about that, you know, that relationship thing, that booze and boys thing. Remember that? The booze is gone, but there was a boy. I mean, he was so cute. And he told me I had cute shoes. Now, I had never been told anything like that. That's not the kind of language that happens in bars. So when he told me I had cute shoes, I married him. We got pregnant. We had baby. We got married. We got divorced. And me and baby moved in with mom and Jim. Mom and Jim decided to move. They had moved back to Texas. They decided to move back to Los Angeles. And I got to go. I was 5 years sober. And I got to go to Los Angeles. My daughter and I got to go. And I got to be in the middle of the most fantastic home group ever. I got to step in the middle of Pacific Group. And I jumped in full force. I was sponsored by Sharon. We were called Barker Babies back then. And I love being, you know, part of that group. And I went to the yard, sort of. I fought her on that often, but I did that yard. My forte in Alcoholics Anonymous is conventions. I loved working on conventions. And I think we all have a gift. And I was in the middle of as many conventions as I could be. When I was probably, I don't know, 2 or 3 months sober, I remember standing at my meeting one night with my arms crossed, kind of pouty, you know, that no one was paying attention to me and maybe this wasn't really for me after all. And, you know, I don't know if I want to be here. And somebody saw my little attitude in the corner and they came up to me and said, you know, why don't you get out of yourself and you see the bread over there on the plate in the kitchen? Why don't you go put that bread out on the potluck table and be of service and maybe you could be a part of. Fine. So I got the bread, I put it on the potluck table and, you know, eventually I got to visiting with the fried chicken guy and I got to know the potato salad gal and, you know, that became my bread. And someone tried to take that plate when it was empty and fill it up with bread. And I thought I about jumped over the table and punched him out. That's my commitment. I'm the bread lady. You go do potato chips. I'm the bread lady. And that stayed with me, being of service, taking commitments. I've done it from that day to this. I have always had a commitment. So I'm 10 years sober in the Pacific Group. I had a 10-year party. Sharon gave me my 10-year party at the Saturday Night Way of Life. I had the job, my dream job. I worked downtown Los Angeles in a law firm on the 26th floor. I had my own office and a girl outside that answered the phone, Tracy Jones' office. I lived in Playa del Rey. It just didn't look any, it couldn't have looked any better on the outside. And I went to speak in South Dakota. I flew home on Sunday. I came home, I locked the door, I turned on my answering machine, and I tried to commit suicide with 10 years and 2 months of sobriety. Somewhere during the night, someone had called, I had answered the phone, and I told them what I had done. And one more time, my mom shows up with the police and the ambulance, and they took me to the Daniel Freeman Memorial Hospital and put me under lock and key. And I can tell you, I couldn't have been more angry at that moment that I now, that didn't work. I'd lost 10 years of sobriety and now I'm locked up. And I'll tell you exactly what happened. What happened is Jack Clater used to say, the steps well worked will eventually lead you into the hand of God. And I can tell you the steps not well worked will lead you right out of the hand of God. I had not worked steps. I was angry. I had a resentment at God. I had secrets. I had not been honest with Sharon. I was not telling her the truth. I was taking actions that a 10-year sober woman should not be taking. And I wasn't telling anybody. And I knew, you know, the book talks about we are restless, irritable, and discontent. And you can be that way in sobriety, trust me, if you're not telling somebody the truth. And I was not. And I chose not to drink because I knew that path. So I chose the suicide path. And I have to tell you that this group stepped up, Pacific Group steps up when one of us is wounded. And I'll never forget the night that Marilyn came down and sat with me for hours and just shared me with me her secrets. I left that hospital and, you know, I tried to get sober. I tried to come back to the Pacific Group and I would just sit in my chair and I would say, you know, I've been here. I've done that. I hated being there. I hated you. I would have, you know, these newcomers come up and say, we're so glad you're here. Keep coming back. And I would say, I taught you to say that. Get out of my face. I hated being there. It was just so uncomfortable. I did not want to be there. And eventually I wasn't. And I was to be in and out and in and out of Alcoholics Anonymous for the next 5 years. I remember Brian A. saying one time in a meeting that he saw a guy in the grocery store line, and the guy had in his basket, he had three Hunger Men TV dinners and a bottle of whiskey. And I knew that was where I was going. That's where I was headed, because that's my life, drinking. I don't have a life and alcohol at the same time. They just don't go together. And I was in and out and in and out of sobriety for the next 5 years. I tried to be sober. I'd get a month, I'd get a year, and I was out. It was Christmas time, and we were back in Lubbock, and we were at my uncle's house. My mom was going to the meeting, and my cousins were going to the bar. And I believe that every decision you make, every day, every moment, you make a decision to either walk towards sobriety or to walk away from sobriety. every decision you make. And I also know that you don't wake up one morning with 10 years of sobriety and decide to get drunk or commit suicide. It's a slow stepping out the door. It's slow. And sometimes you don't even know it's happening if you're not accountable and honest with somebody in your life, like sponsor. So that particular night, I chose the bar instead of going with my mom to the meeting. And, you know, there he was. He was 6'2", eyes of blue, black hat, the best pair of Wranglers I've ever seen. And his name was Shane. I mean, come on. And Shane asked me to dance. He was the best dancer in the bar. And we danced all the way to Vegas and we got married. And he was on parole, so we quickly had to get back to Texas before he got caught being out of the state. And neither one of us had a thing. He had a drunk aunt that lived in a trailer in a trailer park in Austin, Texas. And so we decided we would go there. And I said, now, look, I'm from Texas. I am not going to be trailer trash. That's a bad idea. No trailer trash. And he said, that's all right. We'll just set up a tent. No problem. Tent trash, not a problem. Trailer trash, no way. So we set up a tent in front of the trailer in the trailer park and set up housekeeping. Now, one night there was a drunken brawl and they had one of those big giant blue plastic pools in the front yard. And of course, the fight moved to the outside. The pool got busted and my tent floated down in the water down the road. So eventually we moved into the trailer. It was one Friday night and Shane and I were at the little bar we always went to. And I started out in the disco with the lights, you know, the disco light and the lighted floor. And this is where I ended. I ended up in the bar with the door propped open to the public. So you knew they were open with the dirt parking lot and the jukebox. That's where Shane and I ended up drinking. And that particular night, Shane ran off with a redheaded stripper. There was a bar next door, a strip bar next door. I missed that, you know? And he ran off with a redheaded stripper. And so I decided to run off with his best friend. And his best friend and I went back to his apartment to have a meaningful conversation and have some beer. And this guy forgot to tell me that he too had a redheaded stripper girlfriend. And she showed up there and was not happy that I was there. And she asked me to leave. And apparently I said no. For the next about half an hour, I was in and out of consciousness. I don't really know what happened over the next bit. I just know what the police report said. And apparently I took the bottle of beer and I hit that girl in the head and he and her just beat the living daylights out of me. And I came to for just a moment and I looked up and she was pulling him off of me and she said, James, you got to stop. You're going to kill her. And I went back unconscious. So I owe my life to that girl. She saved my life. And when I came to, I was in the hospital with busted face and stitches on my face and busted ribs and concussion and the works. And, you know, the nurse came in the next day and she said, we're ready to release you and let you go. Who would you like for us to call to come pick you up? And I didn't have a soul to come pick me up. Shane was off with the stripper. I hadn't talked to my mother or my family in a long time. Thank God my daughter was long since in custody of her dad. I did not drag her through that nightmare. I had no friends there. My best friend was whoever sat next to me at the bar and bought my drink. That's my best friend. And I said, I have no one. And she said, oh, honey, that's okay. And I think I just kind of stepped back in my bed because I knew what she was going to say next was going to make it all okay. I knew it was going to be all right. She was going to fix it. And she said, we'll call you a taxi. And the wind just left I was done. I knew at that moment, the gig is up. It's over. No human power can relieve my alcoholism. It's me and God. It's over. And I knew it. And I said to her, please do. And she called me a taxi and I did go back to that trailer. Now, 1 week prior to this, I was riding around drunk one night with nothing to do, drinking. And I had this keen alcoholic, you know, mind. I had this keen idea. My mom was speaking in Tyler along with my sister. When my mom married Jim, he had a daughter, Sheila, and Sheila and I got sober at the same time. She stayed sober. I did not. My mom and Sheila's girls were in Tyler, Texas at a convention. And I decided, hey, let's go have a drink and see my mom. So we drove to Tyler, Texas. I showed up there drunk. Those girls took me out. They cleaned me up. got my face cleaned up, took me back to that meeting. And there was a man there named Vince Yeo. And Vince came over to me and he pulled me aside and he put his finger in my face and he said this, you know, your dad, Jim had since passed away. He said, your dad is a good friend of mine and he would want me to say this to you. And he said, Alcoholics Anonymous is for people who want to save their life. This is a place where people come and they want to get sober. This isn't a social function. This isn't a place for you to show up because you have nothing else to do and humiliate your family and your mom. Now, if you want to get sober, get in your chair and we're here. If you don't, get the heck out. And he handed me his card and said, when you're done, call me. Well, you know, I didn't say, oh, you're so right. I said, up yours. I took the card, put it in my pocket, and I left. Now, a week later, I had just gotten out of the hospital. I was standing in that trailer, and I happened to reach in my pants pocket, and I just so happened to have the same pair of jeans on, and I just so happened to have Vince's card. Now, you tell me God doesn't come uninvited. I knew at that moment, seconds and inches, like Sharon taught me, seconds and inches. I had a decision because there was a beer in the refrigerator. My relief was right there. But there was also a phone and a card. And by the grace of God, I picked up that phone and I called Vince and I said, I'm in trouble. I look pretty bad and I need help. And I want to tell you, when you reach out for help, Alcoholics Anonymous is there. And he called my sister in Norman, Oklahoma, and the Phoenix group came. The Calvary came. They picked me up. They took me back to Norman, Oklahoma. And I cannot tell you how grateful I was to have my chair this time. I sat all the way down, all the way in, and was just, thank you, God, let me have one more chance. Just give me one more chance, one more shot to stay in this chair. And the women in this group, that group, they gave me couch commitments. I had nothing, no car, no job, no money. My face was busted up. I couldn't work. They fed me. They clothed me. They gave me a place to stay. And of course, you know what they do? They get in the car for any event and it's an anniversary somewhere. And you know who the speaker was again? My mom. So those girls, they put yellow cream on my purple bruises and they put purple cream on my yellow bruises and they put glitter on my stitches. And they gave me a boa to do the cover up the bruises just so I could walk in that room with a little bit of dignity, because that's what we do for each other. That's the language of the heart. And I was able to walk into that room with a little bit of dignity and stand in front of my mom one more time. And I just took it a day at a time. I was told, you know, why don't you see about what's going on in three other people's lives? I want you to call me every night and tell me what's going on in Julie's life and John's life. And the next day, I want you to go to the meeting and tell me what's happened. What happened to them? What happened when Julie got her visit for her daughter for the first time? So I started taking one more time those actions of getting out of my head and thinking about you. And I decided, you know, I'm going to go get my daughter back. I think it's time for me to get my daughter back. I'm going to go to the gym. I'm going to lose weight. I'm going to buy a car, you know, all the things that we're going to do on the outside. And someone suggested to me, how about you have the same address and phone number in your mom's phone book for a year? Profound. Who would have thought of that for a goal? And that's exactly what I did. And the other thing that my sponsor said to me was, you will not go get your daughter. Your daughter is doing just fine. She is well taken care of. They have done a great job with her and you are not going to go destroy her life. But what you will do is you will call every Sunday and you will see how she's doing and you will start building that relationship and you will send the check. Every Monday morning, you will send the check. And that's exactly what I did. And eventually, I rebuilt that relationship with that daughter. And eventually, I got my life back in order. There was a man there named Greg. And he and his wife and daughter came and picked me up every morning because I got a little job in a little town in Oklahoma City. We were about 30 minutes away. They would come every morning, pick me up, drop off his daughter, drive to Oklahoma City, drop off his wife, drop me off at my job. And then he would do it in reverse at the end of the day, pick me up, pick up his wife, pick up his daughter, drop us all off. And he did that day after day after day so that I could get a little job and get back on my feet. And I remember asking him one time, how do I ever repay that? How do I ever repay what you have done? And he said, you just pay it forward. You just do it for someone else, and you'll know when you've done. You'll know. And I got a job. I got my life back in order, and I moved back out to California for a little bit to try and just put my life back in order. And I was a single woman, in Alcoholics Anonymous. I thought, well, maybe it's time, maybe I can start dating again. And my sponsor, old Vince, says, relationships are for mature individuals, and that immediately rules you out. And I thought that was really mean. And, Sharon had taught me some things about dating, about, don't answer the door in your wedding gown, and the date ends at the door. When they say, let's watch a movie and hang out, that's probably not what's on the agenda. So date ends at the door. And I started taking those kinds of actions, and I started being courted. I met a wonderful man in Alcoholics Anonymous, and I had the wedding of my dreams a few years ago. I moved to Arizona. I bought a lovely home in Arizona, and just a day at a time rebuilt my life. I have built a fabulous life in Alcoholics Anonymous here. I have commitments in all of my meetings. I love Christmas. I decorate my house. My family hates when it's Christmas time because it takes a week to do my house, but I love Christmas. And I always have a Christmas party every year. And we have a little white elephant and snacks and hors d'oeuvres, and it's always just a lot of fun, and people look forward to it all year long. And a couple of years ago, I decided, I think maybe it's time to, rotate, let someone else do a party. I'm tired. I've done it for 15 years. I'll let somebody else do that party. And I mentioned that to my sponsor, and my sponsor said, oh, I don't think so. I think that's your commitment to give back. You don't always have to give back at the meeting. Alcoholics Anonymous is not a room full of aluminum chairs. It's a fellowship, and that's your commitment. Okay, fine, I'll do the party. And of course I did the party. So it's the end of the party, and there was this new girl that I hadn't seen around much. And at the end of the party, people are saying goodbye, and this girl walks over to me, and she had a tear coming down her eye, and she said, I just want to tell you, I have always wanted to be invited to a Christmas party. I've never been to a Christmas party. And my little boy that's with me, he's never been to Christmas. Every time at Christmas, I was always at the Salvation Army, or we were in a homeless shelter, or we were on the streets. I've never been invited to a Christmas party. Thank you so much for letting me be at your Christmas party and for letting me bring my little boy to Christmas. And about that time, her little son pulled on her shirt, and he said, Mommy, is this Christmas? And she said, yes, little Johnny, this is Christmas. And he said, it's magic, Mommy. And I knew right then at that moment, I had paid it back. I knew what Greg had said many years ago about paying it back. And I knew I had honored him and honored what I was supposed to do in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I could have missed it all. That little baby boy could have missed it all. We started a meeting out here called Get in the Car. Some of you have been. It's a speaker meeting once a month, and I wanted to just bring in speakers so that people here could experience what I've always experienced. It was right before COVID hit, and the meeting was so packed. We were completely out of room. We were completely out of chairs. I was beside myself. I was having to go to the front door and tell people there wasn't even any room to come in. They couldn't even come in anymore. I was hysterical, running around. We've got to find some chairs. I don't know what we're going to do. And people kept saying to me, God's got it. It's going to be all right. God's got this. It's okay. And I thought, God doesn't come down and get chairs. I need some chairs, for crying out loud. If one more people says, God got this, I'm going to scream. Of course, I didn't say that out loud. I said, I know, you're right. You're right. But that's what I thought. Oh my God, I just need to find chairs. I was hysterical. I finally had to just let it go. There's no chairs, let it go. And I went and sat at the front of the room. I sat down in my chair, took a breath. The meeting was about to start. And all of a sudden I hear all this scuffling around, the sounds of aluminum metal chairs on the floor moving around. And I thought, oh my God, somebody found some chairs. And I turned around, and sure enough, somebody just happened to find a door that they missed, and there was a room full of chairs. And I sat back and I said, okay, God, I get it. You do chairs. So, you know, God does do chairs. Howard P. from here used to always say, mark the spot where you found God and go there often. This is the spot that I find God, and I come here often to be with you. Thank you so much for the honor of sharing my story with you guys tonight. Thank you.
We celebrate AA birthdays at this meeting. We define sobriety as freedom from alcohol, pills, pot, anything that would affect you from the neck up. If you're a regular attendee of this meeting and would like to take a cake with us, please email our scribe, Ann P., at birthdays@pacificgroupla.org.
Hi, everybody. My name's Ann, and I'm an alcoholic.
And please email her by 6:30. Otherwise, you'll have to wait until the following week to get recognized. We have several birthdays tonight, and we've asked a special guest to sing us a song.
Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday to you. Happy birthday from the PG. Happy birthday to you. Keep coming back.
Woohoo! And our birthdays for this week are, we have Shua S for 1 year. His sponsor is Alan B. We have Peter H for 1 year. His sponsor is Gay B. We have Steve P for 1 year. His sponsor is Christopher M. We have Mario V for 5 years. His sponsor is Jeff B. We have Amy L for 6 years. Her sponsor is Yvonne S. We have Adam E for 6 years. His sponsor is Mitch R. We have Sarah M for 9 years. Her sponsor is Denise A. We have Janet T for 19 years. Her sponsor is Roz A. We have Ann P for 30 years. Her sponsor is Diane G. We have Laura W for 32 years. Her sponsor is Lynn R. We have Diane G for 33 years. Her sponsor is Judy R. We have Robin T for 38 years. His sponsor is Michael B. We have Miriam K for 40 years. Her sponsor is Mary M. We have Joe R for 40 years. His sponsor is Don P. We have Julian C for 40 years. His sponsor is Thomas S. So we have 15 birthdays for a total of 301 years, the average being 20.06. Happy birthday to all of our recipients. We have a custom at the Pacific Group of donating $1 for each candle on our birthday cakes. At the end of the year, this candle money is our contribution to AA organizations worldwide. If you wish to participate in this custom, please email our treasurer, Betty H, at treasurer@pacificgroupla.org.